Hello and welcome to another episode of Mr. Jeffreon's World History Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Mr. Jeffreon. This week we are going to discuss nomadic empires. If you have any questions after listening to the podcast, I encourage you to call them into the show's Google Voice number 321-804-APWH or submit your question to mrjeffreon@gmail.com. From the 11th century all the way through the 15th century, nomadic tribes played a very influential role in Eurasia. While Turkish tribes transformed India, Anatolia, and Persia, the Mongols were able to create the largest empire of all time, stretching from China to Russia. Before we go into too many details, we should probably define what constitutes a nomadic tribe. Listeners of this podcast will remember back to episode 1 when we covered prehistoric nomadic societies. While some groups transitioned from hunter-gatherer-based economies to an agrarian one, others began herding animals and moving from one grazing area to another. These pastoralists eventually gave rise to great nomadic societies such as the Turks and the Mongols. In Central Asia, there was not enough rainfall to have large-scale agriculture. This caused the Turkish people to conduct small-scale farming and migrate based on pasture lands. They survived mainly on animal products. Turkish people made small amounts of millets, pottery, iron, and leather goods. Turkish nomads would trade with settled people, especially on caravan routes. Now, the Turkish society was split between two classes, the nobles and the commoners. Nobles were people who were charismatic and had the opportunity to assert authority on occasion. Nobility was hereditary. For example, if your father was noble, you would become noble. However, nobility could also be lost in cases of incompetence. In terms of gender roles, pastoral societies remain patriarchal, but less so than settled societies. Women had the ability to become advisors and even rulers. The Turkish tribes never became centralized, meaning a single Turkish authority, but their languages were closely related. They placed large emphasis on clan, meaning tribal family relations. Religion varied throughout the Turkish tribes. Early Turkish religion, like most nomadic religions, revolved around the idea of shamanism, nature worship. During the 6th century CE, other religions such as Buddhism, Nestorian Christianity, Manichaeism, and Islam began to influence and change the Turks' beliefs. By the 10th century, Islam became the predominant religion among Turkish peoples due to the influence of the Abbasid Caliphate. Sometimes a ruler of an individual tribe would rise in influence and organize a confederation for expansion. The horse culture of nomadic people would lend itself to an amazing cavalry force. Pastoral military forces had two advantages over their settled counterparts, mobility and speed. From the 8th century to the mid-10th century, the Turkish tribe known as the Seljuk Turks lived on the border of the Abbasid Empire. The Seljuk began to slowly move within the Abbasid Empire and serve in their army. At the start of the 11th century, the Seljuk had become more powerful than the Abbasid caliphs, who had become mere figureheads of authority. This can be seen in 1055 when Tughril Beg, a Seljuk leader, was recognized as Sultan. Tughril's power ranged from Baghdad to Syria and Palestine. During the early 11th century, some of the Seljuk Turks migrated to Anatolia. In 1071, the Seljuk Turks defeated the Byzantine army at Manzikert. They even took the Byzantine emperor as captive. After the Byzantine defeat, the numbers of Seljuk Turks in Anatolia increased dramatically, causing large-scale conversions to Islam in the area. The Ghaznavid Turks, under the rule of Mahmud of Ghazni of Afghanistan, invaded northern India. By the 13th century, the Ghaznavid Turks would have full power over northern India and tried to force a religious hegemony by persecuting Buddhists and Hindus. The story of the Mongol Empire begins with a young boy named Temujin. In 1167, when he was just 10 years old, his father was poisoned, thrusting him into a life of poverty. This poor child would grow up to become a fierce warrior and perhaps the greatest master of steppe diplomacy to ever live. In 1206, Temujin had gained so much support, he formed the many Mongol tribes into one confederation and was declared the universal ruler, or Genghis Khan. This idea of universal rule is important to keep in mind when thinking of the Mongol conquests of Eurasia. In their eyes, their ruler was the ruler of everything under the sky. To the Mongols, conquest meant merely claiming what was already theirs. When Genghis Khan created an empire composed of different tribes, he broke the traditional affiliations and made men from different tribes work together in a military comprising of between 100,000 and 125,000 people, each of whom were excellent horsemen and archers. The Mongols' greatest advantage was their ability to ride horseback, which would make their cavalry faster than any standing infantry. Those who fought against the Mongols usually overestimated the numbers of their foes. Everywhere they looked, they seemed to be more Mongols. That was the advantage the Mongols had: mobility and speed. To become a military leader, a man would have to possess both loyalty and merit. When conquering other states, the Mongols followed a simple principle: either the enemy surrendered, or everyone in the city would be killed. Genghis Khan began by raiding the Jurchen of North China in 1211. By 1220, he had seized control of North China, while South China was still under the power of the Song dynasty. For now. Genghis Khan went on to try to create a trade relationship with the Seljuk leader of Persia, the Khwarezmian Shah. The Khwarezmian Shah denied the relationship and killed some Mongol emissaries. Mongol forces soon invaded Persia, reduced trade cities to rubble, destroyed much of the Khanate system, and killed millions. A tragedy for the Persians, but just another day for the Mongols. With Genghis Khan's passing in 1227, the Mongol Empire was split into four regional empires, or Khanates. These four kingdoms were the Great Khans in China, the Chagatai Khans in Central Asia, the Ikhans in Persia, and the Khans of the Golden Horde in Russia. We will begin by discussing the most influential, which was under the power of Genghis Khan's grandson, Kublai Khan. Kublai Khan became the ruler of China and established the Yuan dynasty. He is remembered as religiously tolerant, promoting Buddhism while allowing the practice of Christianity, Islam, and Taoism. A European by the name of Marco Polo, and no, we are not talking about the pool game, served on Kublai Khan's court. It's one of the strange habits of the Yuan dynasty. They were much more trusting of foreigners than of the conquered Chinese. Kublai Khan extended Mongol rule to all of China when the Song capital of Hangzhou fell in 1276. 1279 would officially begin the Yuan dynasty. Kublai Khan tried to conquer Vietnam, Burma, Java, and Cambodia, but his efforts failed. He also failed on both occasions of invading Japan, once in 1274 and another time in 1281. The failure of invading Japan is in part due to the bad luck of running into a typhoon, or what the Japanese referred to as kamikaze, divine wind, a name later adopted by Japanese pilots during World War II. Mongols did not want to mix with Chinese society. They made sure to keep a strict separation between their people and the Chinese people. Mongols could not marry Chinese, and the Chinese were forbidden to study the Mongol language. That way the Mongols had sort of a secret code. Under the Mongol rule, civil service exams were dismantled. Loyalty and Mongol blood were the currency of the day. There is a saying among military historians: never get involved with a land war in Russia. No army in history was able to conquer Russia. None, that is, except the Mongols. In 1237, the Mongols established the Khanate of the Golden Horde. Mongols would continue to take over Poland, Hungary, and East Germany. The Russian princes were able to keep some authority and independence as long as they paid tribute to the Mongols. Kublai's brother, Hulagu, captured Baghdad in 1258. The Mongols' time in Persia was known as the Ilkhanate of Persia. The Mongols continued to let the Persians serve in government, as local officials and as ministers, as long as order was kept and taxes were collected. This really wasn't a break in Mongol behavior. They often preferred to keep existing structures in place while they collected the profits. When Ilkhan Gazan converted to Islam in 1294, a massacre of Jews and Christians followed in which 200,000 people were killed. After the massacre, Mongol rule expanded into Syria. Although the Mongols were religiously tolerant, they found the Lamaist schools of Buddhism in Tibet very interesting. The Khans were seen as incarnations of Buddha. The Lamaist schools of Buddhism included beliefs in large elements of magic, very similar to the Mongols' traditional shamanistic beliefs. Under Mongol rule, long-distance trade routes were more secure and safe for merchants. Trade routes began to have relay stations, which maintained a good order for traveling merchants, missionaries, and ambassadors. Mongols resettled individuals from different regions to allow for a variety of different services, including clerks, artisans, secretaries, and administrators. There are multiple reasons why the Mongol Empire collapsed. In Persia, revenues reduced because of excessive spending and overexploitation. The Ilkhan's paper money failed, and the last ruler died without an heir, leading to the fall of the Ilkhanate. In China, the paper money lost its value. Power struggles occurred during the 1320s. Lastly, the spread of the bubonic plague would lead to the population declines in the 1330s and 1340s. The Mongols were responsible for the spread of the bubonic plague, or Black Death, that would spread across trade routes to Europe. Perhaps because they promoted trade, or perhaps they willingly spread the plague as a means of biological warfare. There are some disagreements among the sources. These factors would lead to the collapse of the Yuan Dynasty. The remaining Mongols in China were sent to the steppes by 1368. The Golden Horde in Russia would continue until the 16th century. The Ottoman Empire was led by Osman, who dominated parts of Anatolia when he declared independence from the Seljuk Sultan in 1299. In the 1350s, the Ottoman began conquests in the Balkans. Constantinople was taken over by Sultan Mehmed II in 1253, and he renamed it to Istanbul. Following the conquest of Constantinople, the Ottoman Empire expanded into Southwest Asia, Southeast Europe, and North Africa. While its borders would change, it would last until the end of World War I. The legacy of these nomadic empires is sort of a mixed bag. As Bentley and Ziegler point out, clan-based tribes of Mongol and Turkish nomads directly and indirectly encouraged Eurasian integration during the post-classical era. Desire for fertile pasture lands drove the expansion, which ultimately led to the emergence of the largest land empire in history. Military skill and success characterized both Mongol and Turkish cultures, particularly mounted cavalry forces, which were the physically toughest and best-trained troops ever seen in world history. Religious curiosity and tolerance encouraged conversion of Mongol and Turkish rulers to a variety of world religions, and peace and stability facilitated the spread of others across Eurasia. Although some rulers, such as Mahmud of Ghazni, sought to impose religious uniformity across their domains with lasting results for areas like northern India, the reign of Genghis Khan and his successors created a Pax Mongolia, a Mongol peace, across large areas of the Eurasian steppes, linking closely together vast areas for the first time. Genghis replaced traditional tribal political structure with centralized authority directed from his glorious steppe capital, Karakoram. Stability and security revitalized Eurasian land trade. At no time since has the area enjoyed the same levels of economic prosperity. Of course, the cost of that stability must be weighed against the benefits. While details of the numbers vary from source to source, the Mongols murdered between 10 and 60 million people to establish their Pax Mongolia. I know that's a wide range, but I think it would be safe to split the difference and say that the Mongols killed 35 to 40 million people. If we were to just look at the Mongol conquest of Baghdad, that city's population never returned to its pre-invasion numbers until the mid-1990s. That's a 600-year recovery period. It's not as if the goals of the Mongols were the expansion of trade and the diffusion of ideas such as the magnetic compass, paper money, and movable type. Their goal was to conquer and to collect the spoils of war. Some, like Dan Carlin from the Hardcore History podcast, see this revision of the Mongols as the bringers of a new age who promoted trade and established economic prosperity as being a lot like shooting an arrow at a target and painting a bullseye around where it had already landed. Certainly, the Mongols changed the world, but what about the costs? This is a debate historians are currently having. It's a luxury we are afforded because of our time and distance from the Mongol conquest. If this were the 14th century, and the towns being destroyed were our towns, and if the people being killed were our friends and relatives, there would be no debate. But the thing about being a student of history is we are required to explore all angles in the human story. That's it for today. I highly recommend John Green's Crash Course World History video on the Mongols. And for a different view, check out Dan Carlin's 5-part series on Hardcore History podcast on iTunes called Wrath of the Khans. It is a bit of a commitment, but I can assure you, if you listen to the first episode, you will definitely listen to the rest. Also, for a look at another nomadic empire, research Tamerlane the Whirlwind. I wanted to talk about him today, but we were getting a little long on today's episode. Until next time, this has been Mr. Jeffreyon's World History Podcast.